The DeFalco Files is an entertainment-based program. Some memories of certain events might be fuzzy. All opinions are that of the host. Content might not be appropriate for children and some adults. Listener discretion is advised. And remember, the truth is here. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents The DeFalco Files with FSW owner Joe DeFalco and your host, Matt Michaels.
Hey, everybody, it's Matt Michaels here, and welcome to The DeFalco Files. With us today, of course, as always, is Joe DeFalco and a special guest, FSW First Ballot Hall of Famer Rush. How you doing?
Las Vegas legend too, but you know.
Yes, Russia Mania is running wild on the DeFalco Files today.
So we can kind of start at the point of beginning for you, Rush, to give the audience just a little idea if they don't know much about you. How did you get into wrestling, and how did you eventually start your first meeting with Joe DeFalco, basically? So what got you up to that point, and how did you meet Joe?
We'll rewind a little bit back in about 1997, 98. I still own tanning salons here in Vegas called Rio Tan. Around that time, I had a guy named Buffalo Jim, believe it or not, used to come in and tan. If anybody knows who Buffalo Jim is, you're like, probably not the guy you think he's going to be in for.
See, I didn't even know that story. I'm shocked knowing him that he actually tanned.
Oh, well, so here's the thing. So first time he came into the store, it was actually on Flamingo and Pecos next to Ichabod's down there. He walks in, and I didn't know who he was. And he walks in, and I'm like, is this guy like homeless or what's going on? And he came in and he dropped like $100 and he tipped a $5 bill, actually. But he had every inch of his body covered with, for the most part, long sleeves. This is like mid-July. He had a long sleeve shirt on. You know, obviously had the beard, and just the only part of exposed was his face. I'm thinking to myself, what's he tanning? There's no part of your body that's exposed except for your hands and a little bit of your cheeks, I guess, and your forehead. But he'd come in, and so at one point, I had actually, we were talking, and I, once again, I didn't know who Buffalo was. I didn't, you know, so that might surprise a few people. And also, ironically enough, I had a friend of mine who also owned the La Concha Hotel. And through mutual friends, around the same time, they had a guy named, obviously, Yokozuna, Rodney Inoue, as I said, and Inoue. Was staying there. He goes, hey, there's a wrestler. He was like a former champion. You know, guys who aren't into wrestling don't know, you know, they don't know the nest names and whatnot. And I was like, oh. So I went down and actually met Yokozuna in the summer of 98.
Nice.
Around that same time, Buffalo Jim was coming in. Long story short, Buffalo Jim was starting a wrestling school, brother. Come down, da-da-da. Yokozuna's going to be my trainer. So I was actually the first student to sign up with Buffalo Jim's wrestling school.
Wow.
And it was me and a couple other guys, and it was Yoko at the time, who was still kind of, you know, fresh. I mean, what year was that, Joe? He was a WWF champion in, what, 93, 94?
I was going to say, it was a few years later, so he was very relevant, and everybody knew who Yoko was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, like I said, then I got to know Yoko well enough as to the point of, at one point, he actually rented a house from me.
Wow.
Actually, right before. Anyway, and Yoko was generally a great guy, just, you know, real good person. He was actually only with Buffalo not very long. I don't think he was there for, what, maybe a year?
Wow.
I don't think he was really there that long. And then the trainers kind of switched over to Superstar Mike Lane, and I don't know if Scott Casey ever was actually a trainer at Buff BWF. But then we actually, and then over time, I think if I remember correctly, Joe was, I thought you were in the crowd at, what was it, Silver Nugget, maybe?
No, I was actually, that was when I was doing my radio show. So Buffalo would have a couple, I think it was Johnny Psycho Payne and Mike Lane would come down and promote the show. So he actually had me on commentary.
Hmm. you and Potshot, right?
I don't even remember who it was, but yeah, I was in the audience at the very first show at the Orleans.
Oh, you were? Okay. Remember you screaming my name. That was a good time.
Easy to remember. I was the only one, so.
Actually, that first show at Orleans, it actually drew quite a few people, if I remember correctly. The second show.
Oh, no, absolutely. I always talk that story about 900 people were there.
Yeah. It was packed. And I got the luxury of main eventing against the Tonga Kid.
Oh, wow.
Mad classic right there. You got to find that tape.
That was a... I was called as a, as they say, greener than goat shit, and I learned a lot through that leading up to that match, which I think I may have told the story before. So leading up to that match, this has been obviously the very first BWF show that wasn't in the school. And if you ever, and Joe can vouch for this, in the BWF wrestling school, it had a ceiling that was about maybe 10 foot high, and then you got to throw a wrestling ring in there as well. So there was no top rope action, needless to say. I don't think there was even a second rope action,
which was very disappointing for Rush because that was his main arsenal. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I had to eliminate at least two of my three moves. So anyway, leading up to that match versus the Tonga Kid was Buffalo Jim telling me, brother, I don't know if I should have you wrestle. What's his real name? I don't even know. He goes, I don't know if I should wrestle. Sam. Anyway, he goes, because I'm afraid he's going to shoot on you. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not for nothing. I kind of can take care of myself. I mean, I'm not exactly just a lightweight. And I said, well, nah, I think Yoko won't let that happen. So let's just do it. He goes, nah, brother, I don't want to do that. So at one point, I was going, and Buffalo's like, I got a replacement for you. I go, well, okay, who? Barry O. Barry Orton. Did you know this? Did I ever tell you this story, Joe?
No, I didn't know about Barry. I know he was on the show, and I know he wrestled Too Cold Scorpio.
So this is the first show. So I don't think none of Barry O was on the very first show. It was the second show he was on. So Barry O, I was going down at like 6 o'clock in the morning and meeting Barry O to train for the show for the upcoming match, because Buffalo Jim was afraid Tonga Kid was going to try to hurt me.
Wow.
I was like, anyway, so we went down and I would be waking up and going to meet Barry O. I think Barry O was just finishing up his night. So it was kind of a nice meeting him, you know, smelling like cigarettes and alcohol. And it would come down, and he was actually, you know, to his credit, was actually a pretty good worker. You know, he was very knowledgeable. Long story short, they switched it back. I told Buffalo, let me take my chances with Tonga Kid. Let me take my chances. And we went wrestling that, and it was what it was. And, you know, the whole show, all the Buffalo shows were promoted as the Buffalo shows. It was nothing beyond, it was Buffalo Jim. And I don't think, he should have had Buffalo Jim stand in the ring for 2 hours, and everybody could just, you know, get on one knee and pay homage to him. That's kind of what the promoting was along those lines.
But getting back to and circle the ring with the mechanical buffalo.
Absolutely. Well, put it this way, it was pretty bad whenever, you know, I think I was the BWF heavyweight champion, and Al, Big Al, the alligator, the mascot for the Orleans, got more publicity and more promotion than I did. Second only to Buffalo Jim, of course. Then, which I think I kind of got to know Joe a little bit then through that, just kind of doing that kind of, I don't know if we ever did an interview then, but it was that the time when we started doing the Friday nights KLAB radio show?
Well, we were doing the show, and then the nail in the coffin for Buffalo was the show at the beach. With where I remember they said they paid him about $9,000. Yep. And they had 9 tickets sold, and I remember after the show you came up to me, and that's when you were in the process of starting up this a new school.
Yep. So yep, that's a very little fast forward there from 1990s. So Buffalo's first show was in October 98, ran it inside the school. That's when I beat the, you know, I ran through a list of tough guys like Shooting Star, Superstar Mike Lane, Damian Dollars, El Grande Matador to become the first BWF heavyweight champion. His first real show, I think, was in March of 99. That was like that. He ran a few shows, Silver Nugget and whatnot, and then by, I believe it was, well, it had been February 2001, he ran the show at the beach, like Joe said. That's when all the boys, that's when I got paid a check, and I still got my check around here somewhere, $2. $2 check.
Oh, shit.
Because the Nevada Athletic Commission was in charge of things, so everybody had to be paid. So the ring announcer got $2. I guess it was Jack Slammy, but they had to pay like 75 or 100 for a license, right, to be in the ring?
I think so. I remember that was a time where they actually did the full head. The athletic commission was, you know, doing your vitals, get your blood pressure, they checked your ears, your eyes, and all that kind of stuff. Wow. That was the only time I ever did that in Nevada, obviously. And I think the big main star of that show, which I know one of Joe's favorites of all time, was Big Shot Eddie Cash.
Big Shot Eddie Cash. He laid out Viscera. It only cost him what, $600? They said.
Well, supposedly the story goes, Viscera drove in from like Alabama.
Alabama or Arkansas, something like that.
He drove in, and part of the, I remember Buffalo Jim telling me, "Hey, brother, I've got Big Shot Eddie Cash. He's gonna pay me $1,000 just so he can clothesline Viscera." I'm like, "Yeah, that's absolutely. I would do that too for $1,000. Let him pay." So basically, $1,000 was covered Mabel or Viscera's travel and what he was costing, you know, for the show. Did Viscera actually wrestle on that show? I don't remember.
Yeah, he wrestled, I believe, like three students in a handicap match. It might have been Yoko's brother. Might have been Boom Boom Kamini. I don't even remember.
I had some of the best matches of my career was with Boom Boom Kamini. That night, Big Shot Eddie Cash. I don't know. Are you familiar with who Big Shot Eddie Cash is?
Yeah. Yeah, and for listeners, Joe, why don't you fill in listeners about Eddie?
He was a guy that was a big dude, wrestling fan. I remember when I was at Crazy Horse 2, he came in and told everybody he was Kane. You know, easy to do because he was under the mask. And I remember we filmed, it was by the Silverton, it wasn't the Silverton then, where we filmed the commercial for your wrestling school. And yeah. I believe Eddie was the investor in that one.
Yeah, well, you got to tell the better story, Joe. I think, weren't you in the office that one time at UWF whenever I kind of lost my cool with Big Shot Eddie Cash?
Oh, no. What happened?
I remember a couple times, yeah. I remember the WOW magazine that was involved, and we were setting up the big feud, but he couldn't work a lick, and he didn't want to train. He was just this big dude, but, you know, he'd be good right now if we had those fantasy camps that Sin Bodhi runs where the guy pays, and he pays like $1,000 and ends up wrestling a match or something.
Yeah, he gets to wrestle Ricky the Dragon Steamboat or whatnot. But, yeah, Big Shot Eddie Cash was a guy that kind of I can remember him telling me, yeah, I'm talking to Britney Spears, and I remember whenever a fan calls a wrestler by their first name, like I remember Buffalo Jim used to call, "Hey, I talked to Mark the other day, Mark." I was like, "Mark?" He goes, oh, The Undertaker. Yeah, because absolutely. We all know, you know him as Mark because he's such good friends with you. Big Shot Eddie Cash would do that with like, hey, with X-Pac and like, was a Grandmaster Sexy. He'd call him Brian and not by, because that's, you know, I'm sure that's, how we all talk, because I'm sure you call Sin Bodhi, you call him Nick, right? I mean, come on. and that's kind of where that went. So kind of fast forward to the beach show. I think at that point, everybody kind of had their fill of Buffalo Jim, if you will. And I think that's when Joe and I kind of talked about doing the wrestling school, UWF, so to speak. That was March 2001.
We actually had the listeners voted, and that's how we came up with the name.
Yeah, well, I remember because we were doing the very first UWF show on a Friday night, we were doing the radio show there.
Wow.
I'd moved from being, I guess, Joe's co-host to actually, I don't think I wrestled on the first show in UWF. but memory serves correct, we actually had it was like three matches. We had Doc, which would later become X, and probably one of the Samoans, maybe Reno Tafuli, or something like that. It was like three matches, and then
Major Maniac had to be on there, your boy.
Yeah, actually, no. Major Maniac was loyal to Buffalo Jim originally. He did not come over.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
He did not come over initially. He was about a 2 month. You know, it was kind of like you had to kind of wait for the rest of the NWO to come down to WCW back in '96. We had to wait for Partain to come over to UWF.
And that's when that was the turning point when he jumped ship, of course.
Oh yeah, kind of like when Luger showed up on Nitro. Like, whoa, what's stuff's really getting real now.
Well, let me kind of wrap up Buffalo Jim then, because we're getting now the obviously the split. The first question is, why did you feel the need to make the split? And the second question is, was it ever figured out why Buffalo Jim or how Buffalo Jim died?
Yeah, that's an easy question. Drugs and alcohol.
So here's I'll give you guys, and I may have told the story before to Joe, and I've told it to a few people. So my first time, you know, we're going back to 98, Buffalo Jim invites me to go to a Halloween Havoc with him, okay? Front row seats, Halloween Havoc. I'm like, oh, cool. I'm like, I'm his champion, and this is going to be so cool. So we go to the Halloween Havoc, and we hang out at the Betty Boop Bar afterwards.
Yeah.
It was actually me, Mongo McMichael, Scott Hall, and Buffalo Jim went to the Palomino Club. And then I learned real quick as, you know, how Buffalo Jim's lifestyle was post-wrestling. He wanted to be one of the boys so bad, he would do everything to be one of the boys, but take the bumps and, you know, pay the dues.
Wow.
And that's kind of where I seen what happened after the wrestling shows. Well, Buffalo Jim, as we all know, a lot of wrestlers kind of like to party and whatnot. And I saw Buffalo do some partying. The best part of that weekend, I think Halloween Havoc was on a Sunday, on a Tuesday, I get a call from Buffalo Jim's wife asking if I'd seen him since Sunday. I'm like,
wow.
He's like, I'm not that good a friend with the guy. And I guess apparently Buffalo Jim kind of found out he'd been at one of the local little, maybe the Tinder Trap or one of those, whatever those little strip clubs back in the late 90s was, and been there partying for two or three days.
Oh,
but like
Joe
said, I think, you know, why did he die? I mean, if you're asking me, was he, you know, whacked or no? I don't think so. I think Buffalo Jim was partying, and you know, he wasn't exactly possibly the healthiest person,
right?
And I think he possibly maybe did too much partying, and it caught up with him. I don't think at the time of his death, he was maybe in his late 50s or something like that. But
yeah.
I don't think it was because, you know, the his former neighbor, you know, did away with him. That's just my old boss.
It was the day after he got out of jail, so that's why the rumors ran rampant.
Okay. So basically, there was no closure. No, you know, it just seems like it was probably just partying too hard, and
that would be my guess.
Yeah.
Getting back, you're asking about the separation between, like, say, myself and Buffalo Jim when I left. Him and was after that beach show. It was like, oh, we're done. Obviously, Yoko was long gone at that point. As far as like, actually, Yoko passed away.
He had passed away by that point. Yeah,
and we just kind of like, you know, found a spot. We looked at several spots to put a school. I think Joe, didn't you? You actually went with me a couple looking at spots, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I was pretty heavily involved in the early days.
Yeah. And then Buffalo, then around the Las Vegas Weekly came in and did a story. It was about the UWF, Las Vegas Pro Wrestling Academy, and Buffalo Jim. Well, at that point, Buffalo Jim started offering his school for free. His school was free now. So he was off. So he went from charging people $250 to $5 a month. And it was free because now he had competition.
Wow.
So I think my quote in my line in one of the magazines, I don't know if it's the Las Vegas Weekly, is like, it'd be equivalent to him giving his school for free. It would be like giving away a free buffet with all the food spoiled. and Buffalo Jim, you know, and I'm not to just keep on a rant, but he would claim to a lot of people that he used to be a shoot fighter behind, he'd fight people for money or whatever the heck it was back growing up in, like, it was Ohio. That was all bullshit. None of that's true.
That's kind of a familiar story about another guy who decided to run out here, and he was an ex-wrestler, and he was buddies with all these people. But funny how that works.
And was he a shoot fighter, too? I don't remember.
No, he was just a pro wrestler without a name.
Yeah. But nobody wow. I think I know what you're talking about. But you know, and the thing with Buffalo Jim was never a wrestler. He was never a fighter. As superstar Mike Lane once said, he goes, "He's got hands that are soft like a baby's." So that being said, you know, he was at the same time, here we are, almost 22 years later after his initial school, and we're still talking about him. So he definitely had an impact on, you know, I guess if it wasn't for Buffalo Jim, we wouldn't be on this conversation right now, let's be honest.
Yeah.
He definitely was a character. I remember used to going in there, even when I worked at Crazy Horse too, and they had the beef, because when he had the wrestling going on, you know, I was involved with the wrestling, but I was also involved with that.
and it's, you know, so basically once we parted ways, I think probably maybe the summer of 2001 or two, me and a couple of the wrestlers went down to watch one of Buffalo Jim's school shows, where he ran a show in his little school there with the 10-foot ceiling, and we went there and kind of watched it, and I think that was probably the last time I saw him. I said hello, and it was as bad as you think it would be. So the best story, real quick. So Buffalo Jim used to run a show on what's the, you remember what station it was, Joe?
It was like that 49 or something.
Yeah, it was something. He used to pay a guy to dress up like me, okay, and the guy would be wearing had like a wig, and he had a UWF shirt on, which on the back of the UWF shirt had the phone number, Las Vegas Pro Wrestling Academy, 221-7874.
So you got free promotion?
So I got free promotion. No, I actually got a student from that. I saw your guy on TV. I'm like, thanks, appreciate it. But did you know what, a lot of people didn't know this, so the phone number was 221-7874. Did you know what 7874 spelled out, Joe?
Oh, I you told me. Believe me, no. I know. It stood for Rush.
But yeah, so it was a Buffalo Jim was definitely a character that, you know, had he lived, it'd been kind of interesting to see what he'd be doing today, especially with like Joe's success and Joe and Rocky's success of FSW. I think he would have been very envious of it.
Yeah. So, Joe, what drew you to Rush initially, and how did you guys start forming a partnership, a friendship?
Well, I think it was during the Buffalo days, where I would have Rush on the radio show probably a little more frequently as time passed, and then they were doing that show, and I don't really remember exactly, but I remember him coming up to me that day at the beach to say, "Hey, you know, I'm going to be leaving. You know, I'm starting my own school, blah, blah, blah." And we discussed things, because I always wanted to be more involved in the wrestling business, from the radio show.
Yeah.
And that was actually my first opportunity, because I remember saying to him, I'm like, "Hey, I got the radio show on Friday." And I think it was like from 7 to 8 o'clock. And I'm like, "Hey, I have an idea. What do you think about running the matches between 8 and 9, which was kind of weird. So we would do the regular Wrestling Zone radio show. And yep. Then at 8 o'clock, we would break into wrestling matches. And it was basically commentated over the radio.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, I remember Rico was Constantino. He was in OVW at the time. But anytime he was in Vegas, Rush was buddies with him, so he used to come down, and I remember him doing commentary on some of the shows.
Huh. Yep. And I remember we started, I think our first show we ran was, gosh, I want to say April of 2001 was the first where we actually had the live, the first part of April. Then by May of 2001, we actually got Booker T.
Wow.
It was right after, if I remember correctly, it wasn't right after he just showed up at King of the Ring and attacked Stone Cold Steve Austin on Sunday, then he was with us on that following Friday night.
Wow. There you go. That's a nice little a surprise. Did that help generate some kind of buzz?
With the Booker T?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean absolutely. I mean the platforms you could advertise on. Did we do a commercial for Booker T coming in?
Yeah, we did. We did it on SmackDown actually.
Wow.
Because it was the local CW. And we did, and back then it was like 60-second commercials, not 30.
Wow.
And I remember that place was packed because we did an autograph session. I know you did the seminar with them like the day before or whatever, but we did the signing, and believe it or not, Rocky T was there getting an autograph. Rocky's brother Booker, he had to pay for the autograph.
So what was kind of funny about that, so for those who don't know, obviously Booker T and his brother were trained by Cowboy Scott Casey.
Yeah.
Cowboy Scott Casey was one of the trainers at the UWF for wrestling, Las Vegas for Wrestling Academy. So that's how we got, we got Booker in. Booker came in, and that now this, I don't know if this is probably a pretty good price. By now, today's standards, you got a guy at that time, Booker T was, I would fair to say, he was probably the hottest, one of the hottest guys in the business at that time, right?
Yeah.
If you jump the railing and attack Stone Cold at a pay-per-view, I mean, you got to be kind of hot, right? So we got, I paid for Booker T's airfare, coach on Southwest, and $1,000 is what got him here.
Wow.
Didn't hose you up about with that, too?
I'd pay that now to get him.
But I'm saying, that's why I guess the benefits of knowing Cowboy Scott Casey, there you go. That's the first. it actually drew. I mean, that place was packed that Friday night. And one thing I remember, if I remember correctly, Booker T didn't want to. I asked him to sign some extra pictures, and he was reluctant to do so, which kind of was a little bit disappointing, you know.
Yeah.
And at one point, it was kind of. So we were doing little classes throughout that week, like Joe said, kind of not just a one-day seminar. It was kind of like, hey, I think it was 2 or 3 days. So I was driving Booker, who stayed with Scott Casey, so I didn't have to pay a hotel. I was driving him back to, because remember, whenever WCW closed down, Booker T was the champion, WCW champion.
Right.
So I drove Booker T and Scott Casey back to Scott's house. We all went and had lunch or something. And so I dropped him off. As I'm leaving, I'm about to, gosh darn it, probably maybe about a mile away. I look in the back of my car. I'm like, holy shit, there's a WCW title. I forgot it. I was like, and I think I had a little Motorola flip phone still at that point, where it was. The one Joe, that's what you have now, right? So Booker called me, goes, hey, brother, I forgot the belt, my belt. I'm like, ah, damn it. I was kind of hoping I'd be able to keep it for a few days. But so, yeah, it was a little known story. So I was a... I held the actual WCW championship for about 10 minutes.
You know, it's funny that you said kind of that forgetfulness, because there was one day I was working security Anaheim at the Pond, and it was after a SmackDown taping, and I was out by the the rampway where, you know, they're driving out, they're getting their cars, they're driving out, and we see Booker T and Charmel. And wave and, you know, have a good night, guys. And they turn out, they're gone. 5 minutes later, we see Booker T and Charmel driving around in circles in the parking lot at the Pond, because they couldn't figure out how to get out of there and onto the freeway. It was just like, okay, all right. But sweet as can be, you know, two of the nicest people, so... That's really cool that that Scott Casey was able to get him to come in.
Yeah, and so that was a big turnout. Booker T. We had kids in the ring. He had kids in the ring getting Polaroids and pictures, and Rocky T. Apparently, it was good. I mean, like I said, then we kind of kept running the shows. I think Joe, was that you and Jack Swammy did the Vegas Extreme? Was that over the summer? That was after. I was like,
yes, that was the combination of Triple X Pete Paccio,
yep,
from Chicago. So he was able to get us Ace Steel, and then through Jack at APW, that's how we got guys like Bison Smith, and then the connection in Arizona, we got Gallo, Navajo Warrior, Mike Knox, and then we also had Nykirk, who Jack knew from doing some ring announcing for Les Thatcher down in Cincinnati.
So bring everybody up to speed. So I think that we used to run the 11 live shows on Friday night with UWF and stuff like that. And then was it you and Jack, I guess, kind of decided, want to run their own shows. I think you did those on Saturday night, didn't you? Like on a couple Saturday nights, two or three Saturday nights?
Yeah. We ended up, and we used obviously a mixture of your crew with the guys we brought in. And it's funny by looking at that roster, because the guys from your crew that ended up making it that we used, the Riggs brothers, Snuka Jr., of course, you know.
Was a Funny Bone a job boy for you then?
Yeah, we had a really bad hardcore match that Funny Bone was in. Your boy Technique got to wrestle. His first two matches weren't with you. It was actually with us. And he worked Mike Knox and Derek Nykirk in his first two matches.
So you're saying he went out and get the shit kicked out of him in about 10 seconds then? Or?
Yeah, pretty much.
So that fast. So we've been after UWF. I think we actually – so here's a little known fact, and I'm sure Joe remembers this. So the first time CAC, Call for Alley Club, came to town to run a live wrestling show was actually done at the UWF school, I want to say in February of 2002. And the very first match, do you remember what the main event of the first match was, Joe?
Yeah, it was Brian Danielson and Spanky, now known as Daniel Bryan and Brian Kendrick.
Yep.
Wow.
The first time there was actually a wrestling for CAC was done at UWF school.
And at that time, too, they were both, right around that time, they were still at Shawn Michaels' place.
Oh, they were the super hot indie guys.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So they just went out there and, you know, they couldn't have been, 20, 21 years old at the time. We did that. And then around March or April 2003, I decided, you know what? It's time to focus on my other business, do that. And I actually ended up selling the wrestling school to Superstar Mike Lane and another little well-known guy, Dave Powers of the Power Twins.
Yes, former star of Ocean's 11.
Yes, exactly. every time I see Dave Powers, he goes, "Hey, he's my second favorite wrestler. Hey, who's your favorite? Everybody else." Like that. Anyway, that's my Dave Powers impression. Anyway, so then I think they ran it for, a summer. They ran the UWF for a summer, and then he sold it to one of Joe's favorites of all time, Sammy
Joaquin.
O'Shea.
Was he, the leprechaun or something?
Sammy O'Shea. So, here's a lot of the gimmicks that you've seen, you even carried over into as far as FSW, were creations of mine in UWF, like the Brady A Desire. That was created by me. I know Joe loves that one. Sammy O'Shea, which I always like doing the, if you spell Sammy O'Shea, what are the, spell that SOS, like help?
I created Fredo Dinelli, brother.
Oh, damn, that's, it's funny because at that point I'd never seen The Godfather, so I didn't know it was kind of a little bit of a tough, which I now that later, years later, I thought it was awesome. Iron Lion, Fredo Dinelli. So there's some of the carryovers, like obviously Funny Bone did his own name, Legacy. So when Legacy first came out, and Phil loves telling the story, I told Legacy I wanted to call him Hurricane. This is before Hurricane Helms and all that, I believe. And I said, call you Hurricane. I was taking off that Denzel Washington movie.
Right.
Yeah. So it was the original script was Legacy was supposed to come out as Hurricane. He went and changed it with whether it was Sean McMahon or whatever, and said to call him Legacy. Which, and he's like, and Phil will tell you, I hope he knew he might get in trouble when I get mad, I was like, you know. I don't care. You're a good enough guy. You can call yourself whatever you want to call yourself. So we sold those. Sammy O'Shea took it over, and how long did Sammy O'Shea have his school or what do you want to call it?
No, not very long, because he had the money, I guess, and then he approached me about running it and taking over, and because most of the regular crew, the Partains and the Two Foolies and the Butchers, they were long gone. And I remember talking with them, and we were going to do this invasion thing. and then your boy Scott Casey went berserk.
I always heard that story from different ones, but I never knew the actual. I don't think I've ever heard from you or not.
So the story is, I come down that day. It's a Friday night in the different place down the street from where you were, and all the guys that were like the mainstays of the original UWF. Like I said, it was Major Maniac, it was Tafuli, it was Butcher. I'm pretty sure Riggs, because he was the guy I talked to the most about it before that. And we came in, and I started talking about stuff, and I guess Joaquin never said a word to Scott Casey about this. So I'm walking in, ready, got all the, got the sheet ready for the show. We got what matches. And I guess Scott has his own list of the matches, and he is totally unaware of me being here. And me being the nice guy that I am, after I catch wind of this, you know, I walk up to Scott because I know him. We aren't buddies or nothing, but I remember him from before. We chatted, you know, we got along fine, I guess. And, you know, I said, hey, you know, we're going to be hopefully doing some good things. And before I spout out anything, his first remark to me is, all I want to know is, am I the fucking booker? And I was like, well, we'd like to have you as a part of this. And after that, it pretty much imploded. It was like, let me let it die on its own.
Yeah, Scott was it didn't take long to figure out why, you know, certain people are where they're at in the business, wrestling business. And on the note of Scott Casey, one of the stories I'll tell you, like when you, and I went to the locker room a few times with Scott, compared to going to the locker rooms, when I say locker rooms, WCW or WWF back in the day.
Right.
With Nick Bockwinkel, definitely two different levels of respect. It was kind of like, I've told the story a few times over the years. When you walk in with Bockwinkel, it was like you saw that point all the top stars, hello Mr. Bockwinkel, and like very respectful,
right?
You know, very glad just that he's even there, and gosh darn it, they're showing that he just, it's like, you know, this is the guy we want to be like. This guy's done it all, and he's, you know, one of the best. And just generally, Dick was a generally good guy too,
right?
Walking in with Scott Casey, not quite the same respect level, but one of the funny stories. One time I was back there with Scott Casey at, I think it was at Thomas and Mac, and it was me, Scott Casey, I think Jerry Lawler might have been standing there, and Vince McMahon walks up, and Scott Casey says to Vince, and I'm maybe a year and a half in the wrestling business at this point, maybe 2 years, and Vince McMahon walks up, Scott Casey goes, Vince, I want you to meet a friend of mine. He goes, I want you to give him the chance you never gave me. I'm like, I'm just literally like going, are you fucking serious right now? I'm like, oh, fuck. And it's like Vince just kind of looked at him like, who the fuck are you again? You know, I was like, oh, that's right, you were here for a year back in the late 80s. Cool, thanks. Go hit catering and, you know, go buy a ticket. And it was kind of like, I'm not sure, you know, there's ways. At that point, I realized that I think I know why Scott Casey didn't have a job very long with WWF.
Right.
Let's go to the most powerful man in the wrestling world and kind of give him a backhanded, I guess it was a backhanded favor he asked. I'm not really sure what exactly that was, but whenever he said, give him the chance you never gave me. I'm sure if you think Vince was going to go, by golly, Scott, I've been waiting for this opportunity to give you that, you know, payback for not giving you a run with the title back in 88, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a Scott Casey story. But yeah, just many, and I know Joe's met a lot of guys in this business, but you learn a lot, you know, being in the locker rooms with the WCW guys back in the day. And you know, I had the fortunate pleasure of being in the WCW locker rooms and the WWF locker rooms around the same time. And that was kind of, it was just weird, the aura of the atmosphere compared to two. You know, WCW was just kind of like that when you go to I can't even give it a good analogy. Maybe like you go to a
frat
funeral
party.
What's that?
I was gonna say a frat party.
Oh no, it wasn't a frat party. It was like you walk in. It was like a bunch of people who didn't want to fucking be there. That's what it was.
Wow.
You know, that's what That's what WCW was. It was a very solemn, just kind of not a real positive energy. Just kind of real, I don't say negative, but it wasn't a positive. When you go to the WWF, guys are smiling, they're joking, they're kind of horsing around a little bit. That was just a different aura at the time. Then not too long after that, this was probably, I would say maybe 2000 around, and then obviously not too long after that, they end up shutting a shop. But around that time, this little story. So I actually just got Casey's credit. He put me in contact with Terry Taylor. This was in January 2001. And Terry Taylor, we had talked a few times. Terry Taylor was going to fly me into Smyrna, Georgia, to come and, I guess, train at the power plant for a few weeks. And that was the original thing. So my last message from Terry was, "Hey Gary, Terry," he left a message on my answering machine. "Hey Terry, it's Gary from WCW. A lot of shit's going on right now in the company. I don't know what's going on. Like Brad Siegel is they're selling the company. He goes, as soon as I know something, we'll get you out here and get you going." That was my last message. And then about a few weeks later, obviously we know what happened with this man at WCW.
Wow.
So, and at that point, that's when they, kind of gave me the extra motion to talk to Joe about trying to, "Hey, let's do something. Let's do our own." Obviously, Buffalo wasn't an opportunity, and Buffalo was out for Buffalo. Buffalo wasn't trying to get anybody anywhere. It was a platform for him to promote Buffalo.
Right.
And obviously to, not to jump the gun, but obviously to Joe and FSW's credit, you can obviously see as we talk today, look at the, some of the big names that are out there that are currently, kind of got their roots in FSW.
Yeah.
So, for sure we'll get to that point. But yeah, anyway, so I think I ended up telling that Sammy O'Shea to the wrestling school, and I think Sammy, did Joaquin just close the school down, Joe, or what did he do? I don't even know.
Yeah, I guess it just went belly up, because the reason Scott Casey was so angry was nobody was paying dues to Joaquin, and what they would do is they'd pay Scott, and he'd open the door and train late at night or whatever, and they would just pay him cash directly, and they cut out the middleman, I guess.
Cut off a guy who actually had to pay the bills.
Exactly.
Wow.
Then that was probably, I'm going to say, by that point, we were probably in 2004, maybe, something like that. And then I think, who was the other guy that opened up, they call him Frank the Pug, or another guy that opened a school for a little while?
Yeah, that was like it was in some gym or something. Then he ended up becoming like part of the AWA or something. Remember when that guy was doing like you got to pay to be a member of the AWA, so it was like AWA Vegas or something.
I think something like that. So once I sold the school to Superstar Mike Land and Dave Powers, I kind of was like, it was fun. I'm done with wrestling. It was a good run for 5 years, whatever it was. Had fun, made a lot of good memories. I'm done. And so I remember going to watch that Frank guys, I got invited down. Somebody said, "Hey, come down and watch it," whatnot. And I went down on a Saturday afternoon, probably in mid-July, when it's about 112 out. And I walked in. This was, and I was like, "Okay, this you're doing it. They're doing a show." And I saw the likes of the Rip Malibu, Sebastian Ice. The main event of that show was Funny Bone versus Sinful by Calverson. I still remember there was literally one in attendance sitting in one of the chairs. One fan.
Quick story from that show. That guy was talking to me about stuff, and while I was talking to him, Scott Casey was on the other line telling him not to have me around.
He's trying to sabotage you. The main event was Funny Bone versus Sinful, and I remember watching the match when I think from the lockup on Sinful was blown up.
Wow.
This was the enticement to try to make me want to start wrestling again. This is I'm good. I'm gonna go ahead and continue doing nothing. I think wrestling was kind of in a stagnant form for a few years in Vegas. I mean, Joe was obviously paying more attention than I did.
Yeah, it became possible to do. It was because the Athletic Commission was such a hassle. That's why you never ran shows out, because if we charged, then we would have to deal with all the other stuff. So everything was done. They were free shows that you did, or that one show, I guess you did at Hooters or something.
Yeah. So that's one thing. For 2 years straight, we ran shows at UWF Friday nights, every single Friday night for 2 years. No charge. We couldn't charge, you know. So it was kind of, but you'd be surprised. We had wrestlers from all over, trying to come in. It was a not completely non-pay show because we weren't charging. But I would have wrestlers sending me tapes and pictures to try to want to come in to wrestle, because it was a chance to, hey, you got to wrestle in front of Nick Bockwinkel.
Yeah.
Have you critiqued by him, and I guess and wrestle in front of a live crowd. And
Superfly Snuka was there a lot too.
Oh, and I could, there's another story I could tell you right there, but Snuka and the Iron Sheik story. But so at that time, actually, there's a little known fact. One of the, I remember getting a tape. Now, this is back when you used to send the good old VHS tapes to your potential promoter.
Yeah.
I got an 8x10, a couple 8x10s sent to me one day at the wrestling school. I looked at the pictures of this guy, and I was like, at the time, I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of a cool gimmick. And shaved head, but it kind of looks like he had a little bit of hair in the back, wearing an orange jumpsuit. You guys probably know what I'm talking about, I presume.
Really? Alcatraz, huh?
Alcatraz tried to get booked at UWF. Yes, that's true.
Wow.
Which I think I might have thrown the tape and the pictures away before I ever actually met him. Which, by the way, Alcatraz is a great guy. Like, nothing, say nothing but good things about him. But I still remember I got the tape and the promo pic sent to me in probably around 2002 from him trying to get booked for, I want to say he was asking for maybe $50.
Wow.
was the thing. And of course we had to go explain, like, look, we're not a paid show. We can't charge admission. So if you want to work in front of a crowd, you're more than welcome to. You know, we can do something like that. Most people got it. You know, I had different ones that, we brought in. I mean, it wasn't really. I think Rick Cornell worked with Jason Partain. Well, you were there for that one, weren't you, Joe?
No, I don't remember. I remember him being down there. I don't remember if he had a match.
Yeah, Rick Cornell wrestled Partain one time. Then no pay. And Rick Cornell was, wow, Reno from the what was their name in the WCW? The Phil
Reno.
Well, I know, but what was the group name?
Oh, that's right. Because then he also aligned with Vito when they were the Italians or whatever.
Yeah.
But good story. Yeah, Reno didn't need to get paid from you. He was busy robbing the beach nightclub as a bouncer. So.
And
he told me that's how he paid for his tuition, you know? the line cuts, the good old line cuts back in the 90s.
I think Reno, Rick, he was fresh after being cut from WWF at the time. And he came down, he taught a few classes, and he wasn't as easy to get along with, I guess you could say.
Wow.
As far as, like, at one point, I think I had him training in classes, and I paid the trainers, I paid him $25 an hour. That's what I paid the trainers. And then I paid Nick Bockwinkel. Jimmy Superfly Snuka made $25 an hour to train the class.
Wow.
And they were very happy to get that money. So I did the same for Rick, Reno. I think he had about 6 hours of training one day. So I went to give him the check or whatever. I think we did checks at the time. And I remember Reno, we're in the wrestling ring, and I go, hey, I got your check for you. I got 6 hours. I go, what did I say? You know, yeah, the $150. He goes, just make it for $200. I go, do you want to work 10 more hours this week, or what's going on? Just make it for $200. I'm like, okay. Well, anyway, so I cut the check for $150 and gave it to him. Said, we won't need you anymore. Thanks for coming in. So,
fast forward, another story on that. When we were working with Tyson in Arizona, Johnny the Bull was Tyson's right-hand man.
Right.
So we end up doing the show at Sam's Town, and then Chuck Palumbo, they wanted a book. And I'm like, bro, I'm not paying for all these guys. And I remember Tyson ended up paying him. Johnny got pissed off about Palumbo because I guess Palumbo booked his band out here too at like Vamped or something. Yep. And Chuck was cool. You know, he was a good, you know, I had met him at the Arizona show we did. He ended up working Cash, and that was when Cash was like lean and in good shape and was actually a really good match. But I remember Rick Cornell was there, and basically Johnny the Bull was telling him he was getting booked on my show. And I'm like, it was like 2011 or 12. It's like, this guy hasn't wrestled in 7 years. It was like, sorry, bro, there's no spot for you.
Yeah, if you want to come put over Remy Marcel maybe in the opening match, we can.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was the last time I ever ran into him.
Yeah, wow. I'm kind of surprised. I kind of thought Rico was kind of sour for the wrestling business.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And did you ever hear my? Did you know I wrestled Johnny the Bull before, right? In WWF ring.
Oh yeah.
So a little quick story. So as I'm obviously you guys know, they do. I don't know. Do they still do dark matches, or do they still do that in or not?
Yeah.
If they
actually
need,
no, probably because of all the pre-tapes and stuff.
Only if they need to see, you know, someone who's local. That's when they usually do the dark match.
So about 2000, and I want to say maybe it was 2002. I go down there with I think it was actually me and was it Partain? I think it was, I don't know, a few times. Anyway, I might have went down there with Partain this time. And so we get in there, we show up, you need to show up early. And so they put me, I think it was Finley goes, hey, work a match with Horseshoe, which everybody knows is Luther, who was Luther Reigns at the time. And I don't know, I've seen Luther, or maybe it was Matt, a few times since then, and he was nice as can be. But at that time, so I'm supposed to work a match with Luther Reigns. And so we're outside going over this before the show and whatnot. And so I'm going over the match with him. Everything, we're going over everything like that. And he goes, by the way, I do everything on the left side. I'm like, okay, no problem. We'll figure it out. And so we're going over the match, and I'm sure Joe's been enough part of overheard of enough people going over matches, and they change shit, and they change this way. Instead of this spot, let's do this instead. Da, da, da. Well, Luther, Horseshoe, kept changing this about every, we'd go through everything, step, and then he would change something. Okay, back here on this spot, let's do this instead. Okay, cool. Fuck, I'm like trying to get this down, and you know, you're wrestling, you know, and you got all the guys standing outside the ring as you're getting ready to go and do this. Anyway, so we go through the match, and I'm saying, okay, we do this, and this, and I go, this spot here, which Horseshoe had changed about three fucking times, I go, this spot here, now, did you want to do this? He goes, bro, you fucking got it or not? I'm like, okay. Yeah, I go, you keep changing on me, and so I'm trying to, you know, kind of do this. Anyway, so, true story, as I'm getting, me and Horseshoe are getting ready to get into the ring, Fit Finley goes, Gary, he goes, go with Johnny the Bull, call him the ring. He's out of nowhere. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm like, you know, give me a ring, this fucking prick. So me and Johnny, we sat there and just talked for about 20 seconds. I said, go. He said, you call it. So me and Johnny were in the ring, just called it. Johnny goes to clothesline me. He clotheslines me. Big Show outside the ring goes, Johnny, throw a fucking clothesline. So I'm like, oh shit! So I'm like, I'm coming up next. I'm going to throw a clothesline on Johnny. So I'm thinking to myself, oh, I'm gonna throw it so fucking hard. I'm gonna make JBL close. So I literally clothesline Johnny. Probably to this day, the hardest clothesline I ever threw. Every time, anytime I ever stepped in a wrestling ring, it was on Johnny. It was on Johnny the Bull. Yeah, anyway, that's that. But yeah, so it was. You meet a lot of interesting egos and characters in this business, as I'm sure Joe has probably met more than I have at this point.
So
most good.
Most.
So what? At that time, Joe, what was going on with you as you know? Basically, Rush was kind of, you know, had given up the school and whatnot. What was your path at that time?
Well, after we tried doing the Vegas Extreme thing, and it was difficult because it was at the school, and you know, the impression we got was Rush's trainer, Mike Lane, wasn't very excited of having us doing stuff there and not really wanting the students to wrestle on the shows, which I thought was kind of weird because they weren't really getting experience elsewhere. So the more experience you get, the better.
Right.
And what we heard was they kind of put the kibosh on it. We ran a couple of shows and we were making no money. So when we were bringing in people, we still had to pay a Mike Knox and a Bison Smith. It may have only been $50, but we were looking to see if we could get like a show on CW because there was a guy, Rick, who worked there, who was trying to help us get on there. And he was like an editing guy and he was their main dude over at CW. And nothing really came to fruition. So it was like, well, you can't run events to charge people. And we can't, you know, the product at that time, the production was pretty weak. You know, we had basic cameras and it just wasn't that good. And in all honesty, sure, we had a couple of really good guys, but the undercard was just bad.
Yeah.
And it wasn't TV worthy. And at that point, we kind of gave up what we were going to do. And then fast forward to 2009, which was when they deregulated wrestling. And that's when we put together that first show in May. We had a second show booked that we were bringing Disco Inferno in for. The first one we did the tournament, and that was when Kenny won. So we were ready for our second show. We had a couple hundred people. It was a great debut. And then we had issues with the swap meet with the city saying that public assembly or some crap wasn't allowed. I still think the guy from AU called in on us, but I have no proof whatsoever. So it is what it is. We then got the Silver Nugget. And I'm not sure if it was the first or second Silver Nugget show, but Rush came in, you know, checked it out and stuff, and you know, mentioned to me that he would be you know, interested in doing stuff. So at that point, a guy that was like one of the top guys for his company, Major Maniac Jason Partain, was part of what we were doing. So it was kind of only natural that we kind of set something up between them two.
Well, and I think the, if memory serves correct, I think I actually ran into you and Jack at one of the CAC shows about your, because Jack was pretty heavily involved in the early stages of FSW, right?
Yes.
And it was to, I think you'd asked me, I think you'd asked me to, hey, come in, do something like that. And I didn't really, wasn't really interested for a lot of reasons. I remember Jack was saying something about having, I forget, I think it was some kind of, he wanted to like smack my kid or something. What are you talking about? I was like, a kid's five at the time.
Well, Jack probably was drunk at that time, so.
Yeah, or any time. Anyway, but it was like, that's not a real good sale, but, you know, let's talk, and then we'll, you know, talk about something. And then I think you're right. I think we ended up doing Partain and I, we did something, I want to say, was that the end of 09 or first part of 2009?
No, it probably had to be 2010 because the first show we did, we had Superfly Snuka, and that was the end of 2009. And then the next show was January or February of 2010. That was when we brought in the Godfather.
Yeah, I remember that now. Yep. It was Godfather. I remember the picture of the Godfather hugging Kenny in the ring. That was the time.
Right. And then I guess Partain overslept because he was supposed to work Kid Vegas and then didn't want to.
Yeah, was that the one where I was? Because I think my first actual return to FSW or to wrestling was, I think I wasn't. It was a tag match. It was Funny Bone and Legacy versus, I think it was like Nykirk and somebody else.
Either Modest or Gallo, because they were the elite extremists back then.
If I remember correctly, I was in the corner of Funny Bone and Legacy as the first, my first kind of coming back. I think if I remember correctly, I was in the corner of those two. That was my first kind of welcome back, if you will.
Gotcha. Right. And then, you know, whatever we did early on, then I had the idea of with him and Partain, and that's where, and then Legacy, because after he broke off initially from Funny Bone, that's where the Vegas Originals got created, being they were the old school Vegas guys you know, coming into the new company, basically.
Right.
And for a lot of people, you know, I think Joe probably knows a lot about it, but for those who don't know about Jason Partain, Jason Partain has since, you know, I say changed his ways as far as, you know, he's not completely, he's probably still batshit crazy, but he's kind of found the right path, I guess, as far as the Lord and whatnot.
So no more stink bombs in Iron Lion's car?
I don't think he does that anymore. From what, you know, I text with Jason every now and then, but we've not seen each other in a couple of years. But a lot of people don't know Jason Partain. You know, put it this way. I mean, I've encountered a few different guys in my day that are, you know, pretty tough guys or pretty legit. You know, you wouldn't mess with. I can assure you. I know Joe's had some tough guys and some bad son of a guns in his locker room. I would put Jason Partain against about any of them.
Wow.
Oh yeah, he was definitely one of the strongest dudes we knew.
He was by far one of the strongest guys and by far one of the craziest guys that I knew. If, you know, there's times where obviously Joe probably didn't see it because he was, you know, running the shows at Sam's Town and whatnot. There's times where I had have to calm down Jason because he would get mad at somebody and I'd be like, hey, look, not worth it. Don't worry about it.
Wow.
I remember one time, actually, when the school was on Boulder Highway, you'd booked a match of Major Maniac versus Franco D'Angelo.
Oh, I remember that well, yeah.
I remember that was kind of when you were kind of giving Franco the push or whatever there. And I remember Jason came up to me, and like Jason, you know, Jason liked to joke around a lot. We all love him for that, sometimes a little too much. And I remember him coming up to me. He goes, I told Frank I was going to kick out of his finish. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I wouldn't do that if I was you. That wouldn't be smart. But it is what Franco said to Partain. And Partain goes, I'm not gonna let him pin me. I can assure you, Franco was as big as a guy as Franco was. He wasn't going to pin Jason Partain unless he wanted him to. Wasn't going to happen.
Wow. But he did kick out of the finisher at like 3 1/8.
Yeah. And you can thank me for that because he wasn't going to do the job. I go, dude, just kick out right at the just kick out right at the end. And so that's what that was what he ended up doing. He was telling me, because I'm not going to let him pin me. And he kept telling. And so I finally convinced him, like, just kick out right. He goes, just kick out right as soon as they just kick out right as soon as they count through. And that's what he did.
Thankfully, Rush said to Jason that we would have catering at the next show, so he was okay with it.
Yeah, hot dogs and sodas.
With your experience, Rush, how many times have you had to kind of do that in your career where you've become kind of you became kind of a liaison between, you know, guys and making sure that everything was okay? If
I came from a wrestling background. I grew up in Southern Illinois, went to high school with Matt Hughes. I was from the same high school, Hillsborough, Illinois. So I grew up, you know, with very extensive real wrestling background.
Yep.
So kind of go back. So what I used to do at my wrestling school, and it was more just to kind of, at that time, be cocky and whatnot. So I used to make this offer to everybody. We'll go for 1 minute intervals. And what I would do, if anybody could pin me, I'll give you the school for free. You could pin me, if you get the school for free. So there'd be times on Thursday nights, I think that's when I would teach the kind of like the shoot class, shoot wrestling class, whatnot like that. And you can even ask Joe, you can ask the likes of the Leon Haters, you can ask the other guys that are kind of around, how that went. I did it more to establish, like, hey, this is choreographed, this is scripted, but if you're stupid, you know, don't fuck with me. It was kind of more the way that was done.
Right.
So I kind of, it was more to establish respect, you know, for the guys and whatnot. And so with every time, I can remember, we'd do 1 minute intervals. I'd wrestle, it'd go from, you know, Johnny Rage to Fredo Dinelli to Reno Tufulli, Dave Powers. It wasn't all these little guys. It was all guys at that time. So just to give everybody, bring everybody up to speed, there was a couple of wrestlers, students at that time, who refused to get in, who would never get in the ring and do the shoot wrestling. they've kind of went on to become kind of bigger stars in the FSW and stuff like that. Do you know who I'm talking about, Jeff?
I believe so.
So, anyway, so there was guys they wanted to protect the image of. They didn't want anybody, you know, to make them look bad or whatnot. So, whatever. But that was kind of the, getting back to your question, was, you know, I kind of established, like, hey, you know, we got to kind of get along here. If you don't work together, it's going to be a complete shit show. I've seen guys, you know, get into arguments and whatnot. Nothing, like, ever too bad. I mean, I think I remember one time Partain, we were doing a match, I think it was a Sam's Town. And Partain was, it was me, Partain, and Little Vegas versus, was that Rocky T's match?
Yeah, Devin Walker.
Rocky T, Devin Walker, and was it Jason Cash, wasn't it?
Yeah, most likely Cash, yeah. Because that, yeah, you guys feuded until he became a Vegas original.
Yeah, was, so there was this gimmick, like cattle prod.
Yeah.
So Partain, being his, you know, childish mind, there was the cattle prod, I think, what we did at the finish of the match, where didn't Rocky pin the midget?
yes he did.
So, yeah, we use the cattle prod to take the midget out so Rocky can get the win. You need a cattle prod to get to take the guy who threw the call out. So Partain was walking on the back of Sam's Town, taking the cattle prod, and of course, in true Partain fashion, sticking up people's cracks to people's asses. Well, he went and stuck it up Funny Bone's ass.
Oh no.
And Partain, you know, and it went. So I guess Funny Bone made a comment to him, like, "Hey," he goes, "Don't fuck with me, or I'll do something, or something like that." I didn't hear. So Partain came up to me. He goes, "I'm gonna smack him." I go, "Oh, Jason, don't do that. It's not worth it. You know, what would God do? You know, Jesus, come on, you know, like that, trying to bring in the religious aspect." And finally, next thing I know, Partain just smacked Funny Bone. So I go, "Dude, what the fuck did you just do?" He goes, "Nah, he threatened me, so I smacked him." So I guess that was the extent of it. I'm sure you heard that story, right, Joe?
I honestly don't remember that. I remember at Sam's Town that Funny Bone came up to me that Jason was fucking with him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, "Dude, we're in Sam's Town, bro." It was like probably the first Sam's Town show we ever did. And it's like I had to calm Jason down from trying to fight him and shit.
So as Jason was leaving, I think they crossed paths, and I guess the story goes, I guess Vimo said something again, and Jason just hauled up and smacked him. It never escalated to anything else, but
wow,
it was kind of and that was after me talking to Jason and not doing anything. So imagine. Yeah. So yeah, Jason was definitely a loose cannon back in his younger, less mature days, assuming he's mature now. But yeah, he was definitely one of the, one of the guys you probably wouldn't want to mess with a few years ago. I'm not saying he was Ming tough, but he'd be one of those guys you wouldn't mess with, because there's stories of Jason I know where he would be at nightclubs or bars and would take out four or five guys by himself at a time.
Wow.
Yep.
Fuck.
True story. So yeah, he's definitely was one of those guys that's good to have on your side. So you know, and of course, don't forget Joe. Don't forget the one time when Rocky's dad hopped over the guardrail. Remember that?
Yes. It was like, of all people, to jump over the guardrail at Sam's Town. Because actually, I think we had the little gaps in the guardrail. He didn't even have to climb over. He just kind of walked through. And he basically goes to attack Jason Partain. And we're like, thank God Jason didn't beat the fuck out of him. Because probably would not be running at Sam's Town anymore.
So just to give the full backstory, Rocky's dad, who was no part of anything that was planned, comes over the guardrail and gets, and me and Partain or Jason are in a tag match. I don't know. I think we might have been against the Von Dooms or something like that. And
yeah, because we did the Vegas Originals versus the FSW Originals.
And Rocky's dad, who was a pretty good sized guy, jumps over and comes and stands right at the where Partain's foot was, and starts, because we were obviously doing working heel, and starts yelling. I think I was in the ring at that point, and he starts yelling at Partain. Well, Partain just pulls off and just kicks the living shit out of him. Like, literally just full-on boot to, I think it was know, his shoulder or his arm or something.
Yeah, and he kind of went back. The funny
thing, didn't he?
Yeah, the funny thing is, only two times in FSW's 11-year history has anybody attacked somebody, and both times it was Rocky's father and mother. Heather Lynn was managing Bryce Harrison, and she basically climbed over and started, like, ripping at her hair and shit. It's like, Jesus Christ, we're going to get kicked out of here because Rocky's family doesn't understand. Now we understand why Rocky is the way he is.
It was definitely, I remember that at one point we had like a big debate in the locker room that night. Like, they were kind of getting on Jason, like, yeah, you shouldn't have did that. You shouldn't have kicked him. And Jason goes, which we were all taught, hey, if a fan ever jumps over the ring or comes at you, we didn't know who he was. I never before we introduced the guy as Rocky's father or whatever it was. We was always, told you protect, you protect the business. And, yeah. That's how it was. And so he jumped over, and Partain, in true Partain form, just kicked the living shit out of him.
He showed a lot more restraint than I thought he would.
Oh, wow. No, trust me. Like I said, the toned down version of if Jason wanted to do something, there wasn't anybody stopping him. I mean, I would have had the best chance of slowing him down, but even I wasn't stopping him if he had his mind made up.
But I'll tell you, one thing about him is when he did good business, he did good business. We did against all odds, where him and Kenny were the last two in the match. The winner got to wrestle Cross. And I believe you caught Partain, so Kenny ended up landing feet first. And the main event was Cross and Partain, and Jason did great business, and it was a really good match.
Yeah. That was the one, if I remember correctly, I got the my last bump in an FSW ring was that night, actually. It was a Doomsday Sagittal from Kevin Cross.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That was enough for me to say, you know what? Good run. Thank you very much. I'll wait for my Hall of Fame induction. Thank you.
I was just going to say, Joe, what led you then from the time that Rush, finished and called it quits to the time you started the FSW Hall of Fame? What was the germination in your head? How did you come up with the idea, we're going to have a Hall of Fame and Rush is going to be a part of it?
Well, the idea was initially that if we're going to do this, we called it the FSW Las Vegas Hall of Fame. So at that point, we've probably been around 6 or 7 years. And I thought it would be a disservice to just put guys that have done something in FSW.
Yeah.
So the first name that we came up with was Nick Bockwink. Legendary wrestler, basically lived in Vegas. He was known for being in Vegas. Felt that would be a very strong, opening guy. We want it to be to where people didn't look at it to where, like, when WWE does the Hall of Fame and they put in, like, Coco Beware or Nikolai Volkoff, it's like, eh. You want to talk about deserving, like, Macho Man's not in, but Nikolai Volkoff is. You know what I mean? And it's like,
and S.T. Jones.
Right. And I didn't want it to be that way. And, like Kenny King, he started with us day one. Right. Kenny King is without a doubt an FSW Hall of Famer. But being that he's still basically in the prime of his career, he's not the guy we want to kind of put in.
Right.
So with Rush, it was also the combination of he was involved with the BWF. He ran the UWF. It was where I got an opportunity, and a lot of guys got their first opportunities to wrestle locally. It was more about what he had done in the past than what he had done in FSW, And while the third guy was Alcatraz, and Alcatraz was a guy that, big name in SoCal, one of the biggest, wrestled in Japan and had a great run, and he was part of the biggest main event at the time. We had the first ever steel cage match, made Tyshawn Prince a star, and did his retirement match. He left his boots in the ring. He put over Hammerstone, and I felt at that time that that was the perfect group, because we were deciding two or three, what are we going to do? And we decided that three would be the best number. Yeah. So that's how we started off with the very first Hall of Fame induction.
And on that note, two little things of that, based on what you just said. So a little known fact, Kenny's very first match, live match, in front of a crowd was with me at UWF.
Wow.
Kenny was wearing track pants and no shirt, and his first match was with me as I was was it known that I was the owner of UWF when I wrestled? I guess it was.
I think to some people.
Yeah.
So the backyard crew, Stooley and all them knew.
Yeah. So I put Kenny's first pro match. He beat me. And on the note of FSW, I just want to let you know, and I was thinking about this last night. You know, I do have wins over three former FSW heavyweight champions. I beat Modest, Tyshawn, and Alcatraz. All by DQ, but it doesn't matter. Win's a winner.
Right? But you don't have that win over Young Boy, though.
I do not. Unfortunately, Young Boy kind of came along after my best days were behind me.
Yes.
So maybe if he comes back to the FSW, I'll get that.
You never know. Could be a dream match. It's up to the fans.
Yeah, I know. I've tried to kind of, you know, test the waters and try to get Alcatraz. I go, maybe we come back and do a couple tag matches and stuff like that. I go, you take all the heat, and then I'll come in and shine. How's that?
He was Al was actually down the other day because Tom Howard and Schwag from UPW were there. It's kind of reunion. Actually, Alcatraz had some speakers. He was like, hey, you want them? And it's like, sure. They got stolen the last time Chris Bay left the door open. Oh. So I went to see Al, and he had the really white ZZ Top beard, if you saw the picture on Facebook.
Yeah. And I was like, who's this old guy? I'm like, oh, crap. I'm like, okay. Al's a great guy. Like I said, I've kind of tried to test the waters of, you know, every once in a while you kind of get the idea like, hey, let's maybe do one more one more last hurrah. Then, you know, you start thinking about the actual training and actually, you know, taking the again. And then you're like, you know what, let's let the other guys do it.
Well, you know, we could do something like when Jericho beat the old timers. Remember, he beat like Snuka and Steamboat and somebody else in a WrestleMania match. Maybe we could set something up for the anniversary. On the anniversary show, since we have to have some new inductees and things like that, maybe three ex-FSW Hall of Famers get taken out by, you know, one of our top heels or look to take out one of them.
Would it involve taking bumps?
I guess you'd have to do rock, paper, scissors. One of you would have to take a bump. So.
I tell you what, Bryce Harrison, he's a Hall of Famer. So why don't you bring him in for that spot? And,
yeah, he's MIA. He was supposed to be at the anniversary show. We haven't seen him since.
Oh, I said it. You may have Disco. Disco's a perfect. Disco's
there
a
you
perfect.
Go.
He's gonna be me, Albert Stratton, Disco. We'll have Disco take all the bumps, and we'll just take a powder, and we'll get you guys some heat.
There we go. Might have our first match signed for the 11th year anniversary show. That's still on hold. That we're hoping that in mid July, we're looking at doing a 2-night. Anniversary weekend.
You got to do, Joe, all you got to do is just say you're having a protest and you'll be fine.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, you know what? That's not a bad idea, Joe. Just make up.
Well, I was thinking we were going to have a George Furman birthday party of 50 people, no. Invite only. And now it's a private gathering of 50 people. That's okay. Legal.
I was going to say just donate a portion of the proceeds to Black Lives Matter and you should be okay, but sure. The 50-seat George. Oh man,
he said George. He said George Furman.
Not George Foreman.
No, there's a fan named George Furman, right? But it's a very common name, kind of going around right now.
Yeah, he's looking for his celebrity wing Hall of Fame status in FSW, George.
You do have a you have a couple fans there now?
We have one from last year, Tony and his wife. She passed away, and you know I remember seeing her, and she was like on her deathbed, and wanted to see the FSW shows. That was her release, her outlet. She loved coming. No matter, you know, how bad she felt.
Yeah.
So is there a 2020 Hall of Fame coming up?
There is. Technically, we were looking at it. You know, we've talked about some numerous names, you know, about always like to bring that name from back in the day. So, you know, Mike Modest is a guy that we're, you know, looking at to bring in.
Yeah, I have the dubious uniqueness of only, you know, I'm the only guy in FSW who I'm in the Hall of Fame, and I've actually had the honor of inducting another Hall of Famer. Am I the one saying that, correct?
And we were shocked that, you know, Disco Inferno had the second longest speech, too.
Hey, you're welcome. Well, you know, first of all, for your inaugural Hall of Fame, you got Nick Bockel's wife and Alcatraz. We knew Nick's wife wasn't going to talk much, and Alcatraz.
And then it said, "Hey, Alcatraz and Rush, you got 30 minutes." Alcatraz says, "I'll take one of the minutes, Rush, and you take the other 29."
I think he took 30 seconds, but yeah, I know what you're saying. But it was like, hey, you know what? You got to get these people. You charge them good money. I want to give them their money's worth. And once again, you're welcome.
So, Rush, thinking about the experiences you've had with Joe over the years, is there one moment as we're starting to get close to wrapping up here that sticks out in your mind as your favorite Joe DeFalco story?
Favorite Joe DeFalco story. So, I don't know if it's a favorite. It's the one that I kind of look back and laugh now. So, I think, one time, so we're going back early. I was at Silver Nugget. I was set to wrestle a kind of a newcomer coming up at the time, a guy named Mike Delight. Okay. And it was a haircut match. And at the time, I said, you know, kind of idea. I mean, Joe's the booker. And as I always learned from Mike Lane, the booker's always right. And I said, you know, hey, what about this? I said to Joe, I said, what if, you know, I beat Mike, but they come in, they knock me out, and they still cut my hair? Could you imagine the heat he's going to get? Because he lost, but I still got my hair cut. You know what I'm saying? That was like, and Joe was like, yeah, he liked the idea. Well, that day, Mike Delight, which Mike's a friend, and I'm just talking about this now because this was many years ago, Mike reached out to Joe, and he was all upset because he wasn't going to get to. He was upset because he'd never won a match yet in FSW.
Oh, my God.
And so it was kind of like at that time, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? This guy's worried about winning? I go, dude, you're going to get so much fucking heat because you're gonna beat me. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm going to beat you, and you're still gonna cut my hair. And for many, many years, I thought it was just a laughing point like that because Joe was kind of Joe's early on in the booking aspect, and it was kind of that let this, you know, this guy. And I remember Mike Light. He went on Facebook, if I remember correctly. He goes, now I know how Billy Kidman felt when he wrestled Hulk Hogan.
Oh!
He fucking beat Hulk Hogan. What the fuck are you talking about? Are you serious?
I remember that Kidman remark, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, it was just kind of funny. And that's not so much a Joe DeFalco memory, but I just remember I remember going up to Joe at the Silver Nugget, and he's saying he switched because he liked the idea. I win, but they still cut my hair. It gets you your finish, but now guess what? How much fucking heat do you put on the guy who lost, but he still got to cut the baby face's hair?
Yeah.
And Joe liked it, and Mike, I remember walking up to Joe at Silver Nugget, and I go, then I heard that the finish got switched back, so Mike could pin me. Or that was one, remember, where Leon, I think it was Leon Hayter, hit me with a suitcase, or hit me with a briefcase, would barely touch me. And I had to sell it like I just got hit with a hammer. But it was like barely touched me. And then anyway, but so the finish got switched to Mike Delight pinning me, and they got to cut my hair. And Mike Delight ran around with my ponytail for, I think he might still have it to this day. I'm not exactly, but and he was very proud of that. But I just remember that that was early on in the FSW days of that. And I always got a kick out of it looking back of how that. This novice guy who he was upset he never won a match, and he actually convinced Joe to let him actually win the match.
Well, I don't even remember that. I remember the match and all the other stuff. I don't remember him talking me into it.
Yeah, well, it was kind of like, well, I remember coming up to you. You were kind of in the little, I guess, whatever the Silver Nuggets gorilla position was, and you go, hey, we're going to go ahead and switch it back to Mike's going to pin you. I'm like, I go, and I remember saying to you, I go, I mean, obviously you had a lot going on then, and I go, really? I go, you let the green guy switch, change your mind? Like, whatever. And I was like, okay, whatever. It's your show. I'll do it. I was thinking long term. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you think long term, hey, we'll get this guy a, you know, but, you know,
I'm gonna be irritated all day thinking that I did that. Man, that shit would never happen today.
Knowing what you know after the fact, of course, yeah. But at the time, I was kind of like, at the time when it happened, I was like, "Are you fucking serious? You let this guy who's he literally and Joe knows this. There's guys that don't like to lose, and
right.
That's, you know. So here's a little quick story before we cut off here. So I came up during the FSW run with a run of not being pinned or submitted for, what did we get up to, 800-900 days, something like that. That was my idea. I was like, you know, because it was my idea to say, hey, Joe, what do you think about this? Joe liked. But if you remember correctly, I think I wanted to turn heel towards in FSW. Joe and Modest were against that. They didn't want me to turn heel. Do you remember that? Joe?
Yeah, but I think we worked it into, was that because the Vegas Originals, wasn't that a whole heel deal to begin with?
Well, now Vegas Originals was after I turned heel. Remember, it was we did the match with me and Tyshawn at Sam's Town, and I got carried out on the stretcher. And
yes.
And people were calling. You know, I remember Jody Harris called, and she was like calling and messaging me like in a panic, wanted to know what hospital I was in. And I got a few people last that were messaging me on Facebook and whatnot. But, you know, I'm like, I kind of want to, you know, I'm I like that old school, like, hey, protect the business. We, you know, we as much as you can.
Sure.
They just, it adds that mystique, if you will. But it was, you know, I said we ran with the Legends title. That was the title that I kind of created in FSW, and I kind of wanted them to start defending it. I think Greg Romero, when he actually eventually pinned me, I think he had the. Was he the Legends champion? He's technically still the defending Legends champion. Is that right?
I don't know if we ever put that belt on, because I don't remember him being the Legends champion. I just remember you two guys had the shortest steel cage match in the history of professional wrestling.
I think that was my swan song, wasn't it? I remember that. Yeah, doing the cage match, I think it was like to jump from the to actually get out to the ground. It was about a 27-foot drop. Like, I'm not quite that much of a daredevil, thanks though. But yeah, that was I think we pulled a solid 5 minutes there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was about 5 to 6.
Well, on that note, we are going to have to wrap up for today. But Rush, it's been a pleasure having you on and hearing the stories between the two of you. And you know, I mean, it's very hard to sometimes put in words what a wrestler means to their fans and to their city. And I think that everyone who's seen you wrestle, everyone who followed your career, who was at the Hall of Fame, you know, it's just a great opportunity to, you know, give a little love to you, because you definitely are someone who's influenced the Vegas area and professional wrestling, man.
I appreciate that. And like I said, I love seeing what Joe and Rocky have done, and what obviously all the, you know, the careers of the Chris Bays, obviously Kevin Cross, that have basically started in Vegas. They started in Vegas, yep. And they started with FSW. And that platform, you know, I always, you know, am very proud to see that they had that opportunity to do that here at Starting Vegas, thanks to Joe and Rocky. And I, you know, thank you to tribute. Like, I'm glad that I got to be a part of it at some point, to where it all kind of, from Buffalo Gym to UWF to FSW, it all kind of, you know, falls together to where those guys got the platform to, you know, to do that here in Vegas, thanks to Joe, which all kind of, you know, led into that over the years, which is great. You know, Vegas is kind of becoming a bit of a, you know, stepping stone to maybe the big time at this point.
Well, hey, you know, if your kid's baseball career washes out, maybe he could be a wrestler. We have a father son match, you know.
He's got about as much interest in wrestling as I do pickleball. How's that?
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you once again, Rush. Joe, any final thought?
No, I got to take the kid to the doctor today, so he hurt his knee.
Oh, Well,
is he like 24? So, is he like 24 now?
Huh?
Is he like 24 now?
How old is Joe? Yes, he is. 25.
25, and you're still chauffeuring him around. Come on now.
Well, he doesn't have a license.
Well, yeah, did they make those tests hard now, or what's going on?
For him, I guess so. You know.
Get him a bicycle. All right.
Well, hope everything goes good with Joey, and hope his knee isn't messed up to where he's on crutches.
He got injured at the filming of the Flight of Misfortune. Hopefully you guys got to check out, which I thought was tremendous, the cinematic match between Sky High and The Unguided.
Yeah.
Yes, Remy Marcel sent that to me yesterday. It was very good. Definitely unique, but I would definitely watch it again.
Yeah, you know, great work on all parts. Remy handled a lot of on-site. You know, we had discussions about what we were looking to do, and I really think it helped elevate Sky High, and everybody's expecting good things from The Unguided anyway, and this is just part of it. You know, we did the Kevin Cross watch party for NXT, and we had 20, 30 people there, but they were our loyal followers and fans that, you know, love everything FSW, and they were there to support Cross. We played the match for them, and the only issues we had was they basically cheered everything The Unguided did.
That's cool. Yeah, that's the opportunity. Like I said, you see guys like Kevin Cross, which we all know are going to be, you know, Kevin from the first time you meet him to now, and I'm sure that's why he'll have success in WWE, because he knows how to play the game. He checks all the boxes that you need to succeed in this business.
Yep, exactly. Well, on that note, everyone, thank you for listening to the DeFalco Files. Next week, we'll be back with a fresh show. And until then, remember, the truth is here. Keep listening. Tell your friends to subscribe and download. And we appreciate you guys listening. Thank you, everybody. And have
Go to Rio. Go to Rio Tan.
And definitely keep your eyes and ears peeled for information on FSW. Check the website frequently. Watch
June 20th, tentative next date, June 20th at the FSW Arena. Details coming soon.
There you go. All right, everyone, have a great week. Bye-bye.